Hi, I'd like to welcome Joe Natale, President and CEO of Rogers Communications. Joined Rogers last April as President and CEO, and prior to that, he was President and CEO of TELUS. So my name is Richard Cho. I'm part of the Canadian Communications team here at J.P. Morgan. Would like to first start off with wireless. We're seeing really nice growth, a growth resurgence, so to speak, after a few lean years. What do you think is driving this subscriber growth, and what are you seeing?
Well, I think overall, I believe Canada is the most underpenetrated and fastest growing wireless market in the developed world. Overall, we're sitting at about 86% penetration. And there's no reason why we shouldn't, in the fullness of time, get to the U.S. levels of roughly 120% penetration. You couple that with a growing population, about 2% population growth driven by immigration, housing starts, continuous growth in housing starts, sort of a good backdrop for continuous growth in the market as a whole. As the largest wireless player, and having a strong history of both leading financial and subscriber metrics, I think we're well poised to take advantage of that growth.
The Canadian wireless market has been pretty competitive for a long time. How would you characterize the environment now? And are you seeing someone try to take more than their fair share, or is it just kind of falling out naturally?
I think when you've got, you know, last year we had 5% penetration growth. This Q1, again, 5% growth. 5% growth kind of translates into anywhere between 1.3 and 1.5 million new customers per year. I think there's a lot of opportunity for all the players to get a requisite share of the market with that kind of growth. As a result, we're seeing a competitive market, but also a disciplined market from that perspective.
And I think between the kind of relative sizes and networks, I think the Canadian market, since it's growing, you're not seeing any kind of irrational behavior by any players, something that I guess we're seeing down here once in a while.
You know, Canada is largely a postpaid market, similar to the U.S., is a market that's inherently based on subsidy versus equipment financing. It's a market with a low population density, 3.5 Canadians per square kilometer. And therefore, like, playing in the wireless game in Canada requires deep pockets and requires an investment in infrastructure based on both the regulatory environment and the expectation of Canadians for high-quality networks. We have amongst the highest quality networks anywhere on the planet, with very strong performance in terms of capacity and coverage as a whole. And I think it's given rise to a certain type of wireless market. You know, if you could look back at the history of wireless in Canada, it's about 35 years old. As an industry, we became cumulative cash flow positive about 8 or 9 years ago. So I think, you know, that by definition means a marketplace with much more of a focus on making sure that there's proper economic returns coming out of that investment as a whole. We don't have the T-Mobile effect that we've seen in the U.S. market. Yes, there are, you know, four players in each of the key markets, but the current environment really strives for a balance of competition with strong economic consideration.
And to go along with that subscriber growth that you've seen, ARPU and service revenue have been growing. I assume that part of that is being driven by increased usage on the higher quality networks. What are you seeing usage-wise, and where could service revenue and ARPU growth go over time?
That's a great question. We think there's a continued opportunity for more revenue and ARPU growth as a whole. So on average, Canada has about a gig of data usage per month per subscriber. The U.S., the number is roughly around three times that amount because of unlimited plans in the U.S. We don't see any sort of overall push for unlimited in Canada just because the quality of networks in terms of expectation and the expense of covering our vast geography would really kind of hurt the infrastructure and the investment that's been made to date. You know, we cover 98-99% of Canada, and think about Canada as one of the largest land masses on the planet with LTE because of that investment thesis as a whole. So, as it relates to that sort of overall, kind of economic condition, I think we're kind of in a good spot with respect to the future of wireless and the thesis for investment around it.
As long as it's done in a rational kind of investment manner, do you expect the 1 gig to eventually move up to 2 and maybe 3 over a long period of time? But it doesn't seem like there's any reason why Canadians wouldn't be using their phones as much. It's just maybe the economic impact.
No question. I mean, I think the network experience is far different in Canada than it is in the U.S. I mean, I've traveled all through the U.S. I've got a lot of family in the U.S. It's a bit of a different network experience as a whole. I think there's room to monetize that data on the road from 1 gig to 1.5 gig to 2 gig based on providing value. Naturally, the market is growing by about 30 to 40% per year in terms of increased demand for data in Canada. The key is to make sure that we continue to deliver on that demand to customers, at the same time drive out costs in our business and our infrastructure so we can realize the economic value of marching from 1 to 2 to 3 gig.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of improving that value is the high-quality network, but also getting churn down and being able to keep customers longer. What has Rogers been doing to lower churn and get that under 1%?
We've been working hard on that front. We posted another great quarter in terms of overall postpaid churn performance at 1.08%, down a few points from a year ago, and the best record in many years in our business. And we're going to continue chipping away at churn. We already lead the industry with respect to gross loading. We have one of the strongest distribution networks and have led quarter on quarter for years in terms of gross additions. Our goal is to get churn to a leading performance level as well. That's going to be done with a combination of efforts, one around just driving far greater customer service capabilities, driving far greater self-serve capabilities for our customers. That's going to be done through much better and stronger focus on managing our base of customers proactively, using analytics and all kinds of outbound efforts and activities. And we're just starting to mount some of those efforts. Our goal is to have the best of both worlds, and we think we can have the best of both worlds, and that is industry-leading gross loading with industry-leading churn performance in the fullness of time. We're not going to get there overnight. It will take a lot of heavy lifting through the course of the next few years, but the trend line will continue, and we'll continue to chip away at it a few basis points each and every cycle as a whole. I think it's there for the taking. There's nothing structurally holding us back from doing that. But the important thing to consider is that churn improvement, customer service improvement, goes hand in hand with cost improvement. The two are really two sides of the same coin. You know, there's a fallacy out there that says in order to improve customer service and improve churn, you have to somehow spend more money. We believe by systematically going after the friction points, the problems around churn, will actually take cost out of the equation. We, as in a simple example, last year we took almost 47 million phone calls at roughly $10 a phone call. It's a very expensive cost of operating one part of our operations, and similar kind of cost points across stores, across our field technician force, et cetera. So we're on a mission to just drive that call volume down and really kind of focus on the calls that add the most value to customers, take longer on the calls that matter more, and eradicate the calls that aren't adding any value whatsoever. And that's part of the churn equation and the margin improvement equation.
And then going along with that, is this a long-term kind of keep working at it, changing the culture or adjusting the culture internally and seeing that improvement over a short period of time, or is it going to take a while?
It's going to take a few years to get to where we want to get overall, and we're just going to keep chipping away at it. If it was one or two things to fix, we would have done it by now. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, we started this routine of looking at friction points based on ideas that come from both our frontline agents and come from customers directly. And in Q1 alone, we remediated about 54 different items that, you know, are starting to kind of have some traction. Some of them affect a small group of customers. Some of them affect thousands of customers. If there was one or two key ideas, we would have, you know, already kind of been done with them. We got here through sort of a series of increasing complexities in our business, not really kind of making some of the correct investments in terms of customer service along the way. And we're going to make our way to a better place by kind of reversing some of those items and making the right investments, but it's going to take time to do so. It's sort of a game of inches that you play over a long period of time. And you hit the point as well, Richard. You know, culture is a big part of it. It's one thing to kind of go after all these points, but you have to build a culture where serving the customer and putting customers first is top of mind every step of the way in everybody's activity, whether you're on the front line or whether you're in product management and marketing and finance or legal. It has to be an important part of your thinking.
Makes sense. You mentioned gross loadings and how Rogers has led there. Is it driven by brand or distribution, both? Can other companies kind of catch up to your level of distribution? Just wanted to get a sense.
Yeah, I think it's driven by a few things. One, it's driven by the quality of our network. We've got a very strong and capable network. I talked about that already. Secondly, it's driven by the strength of our distribution. Our products are offered in about 2,500 points of distribution across the country. 1,000 of them are exclusive to Rogers brands. The remainder are a series of either joint ventures or independent third-party retailers. The category, wireless for sure, is over-distributed in Canada. So there's not exactly a lot of room for more points of distribution. You go in the average mall and there can be 10, 20 places to buy a wireless device. And landlords are saying kind of enough. We understand we're well covered. But, you know, we built that distribution network over the last 35 years. And it's something that is a strategic advantage for us as an organization. We continue to invest in the nature of those stores. You look at some of our new format stores. These are places to experience what's happening in the world of wireless, in the world of cable TV, in the world of internet, and how the wireless world and the smart home will come to fruition for customers. And more than ever, we have to be at the forefront of sharing those ideas with customers, and the store needs to be a destination, not just a place to pay your bill or look at a phone or a device. And I think that's the game we're playing. And, you know, the barrier to both investing in networks is high. The calculus of our business really trades on population density. As I talked about earlier, population density in Canada is about one-tenth of the U.S. So we've built we have the largest owned wireless network in the country with some 8,000 macro towers and a growing array of small cells at the same time. That took a long time to build, and we're covering every nook and cranny of the country. Add that to the distribution footprint, and those are things that are hard to overcome if you're newer to the game.
Yeah. I guess you've developed your 4G network to a pretty high standard, but a lot of people are talking about 5G. And how is Rogers' network pre-positioned in its 4G network, and how do you think the transition will go to 5G?
Well, right now we're just in the middle of a network uplift program to make the transition from 4G to 4.5G. 4.5G will be a number of technologies that are fully leverageable into the 5G world. One thing we've done recently is we've chosen Ericsson as our national partner for the 4.5G uplift is we're picking the latest radio access gear that is not only capable of supporting multi-carrier aggregation, supporting 4x4 MIMO, all the things that are part of 4.5G, but it will be 5G ready in terms of only requiring software upgradable efforts to make the move to 5G. So that's one thing that we're doing. The second thing that we're doing is a series of 5G trials across our business. You may have seen recently that we're testing some of the high-capacity, high-volume capability of small cells in 5G. We lit up 100 small cells inside the Rogers Centre where the Toronto Blue Jays play, and we saw incredible performance. And I think, you know, 5G plays a role in venues. I mean, when that stadium's at full capacity, it's almost 50,000 people trying to stream video all at once. is a very important sort of test case or condition for one of the 5G applications. We're also looking at the various industry verticals around IoT and asking ourselves the question, you know, which industries will be most predisposed to making an investment in IoT capabilities in Canada. And we're going to be at the forefront of those industries. It's largely a B2B play. We've got a strong capability in that arena, and we'll be leveraging that. The third area that we're watching very carefully around is fixed wireless. We're going to watch carefully as AT&T and Verizon and others across the globe kind of build the case and build the technological solutions for fixed wireless, and we'll be there kind of ready to understand how well that's going and be a fast follower and kind of looking at where that's evolving to. So those are the three sort of overall areas for 5G. Mm-hmm. This will be a year of planning, of economic case development, of starting to do some of the foundational work. And then as we head into 2019, we'll see much more of a building phase starting to emerge based on where we're placing our bets. The thing about 5G that's important to understand is that 5G is not like the move from 3 to 4G. 3 to 4G was a rip and replace of the entire infrastructure. 5G will happen in an evolutionary way based on the use cases that we pick, the geographies where we want to implement those use cases, and be much more evolutionary in nature and much less significant of a massive sort of capital campaign like 3 to 4G was.
In terms of the fixed wireless offering, given that you're already building or have a very strong network, is this an out-of-footprint opportunity for you, and how big could that be? How much work have you done there?
So our focus right now is in footprint. We pass about 4.3 million homes with our cable footprint. We have the largest cable system in Canada in terms of addressable homes. We've already rolled out DOCSIS 3.1 to the entire footprint. So the entire footprint is capable of 1 gigabit speeds to each home location. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've been running fiber to the prem in any new builds, whether it's a brand new single dwelling subdivision or whether it's new condo buildings. And if you've seen some of the housing development in the economic center of Canada, where we have most of our footprint, in Toronto and the surrounding area, you'll know that there's been a lot of housing development, a lot of condo towers being built. So we feel we're very well equipped. We'll look at fixed wireless as sort of a complementary idea within that footprint. And right now, it really becomes an economic trade-off. Do we, you know, as we look at adding capacity, building out on the fringe of our network, do we do so with fiber, do we do so with coax, or would we try something with fixed wireless? And until the case is proven on fixed wireless, we'll just be doing some trials and watching it evolve. We have no plans right now to go outside of footprint, and really focusing on the footprint that we have and continuing to drive the growth that we're seeing in that business.
In terms of small cells, do you see that as a cost savings in terms of building capacity that people are using, or is it really expensive to build and it's very targeted?
We see small cells. The biggest opportunity around small cells is to offload the macro network. The macro network in some parts of our network is such that we just can't keep adding macro towers. It's becoming more difficult to actually get sites in some of the urban dense areas to add another macro tower. And you get into the sort of law of diminishing returns. You continue splitting cells in an urban area, and you actually don't get double the capacity. You get sort of a diminutive kind of outcome from that. So to me, the most obvious application of small cells is to offload the macro towers in dense urban settings, where you can attach small cells to buildings, street furniture, to bus stops, wherever you can get access, backhaul, and power. And I think that's the great complementarity of small cell to macro cell. At the same time, we leverage the power of 5G to do things like network slicing, to manage quality of service in a different way, and start to evolve the proposition. You know, we've grown up in this business with tonnage being our main focus. How many gigs can I sell you? I think there's an opportunity with 5G to, you know, have different sorts of value-added transactions priced differently. You know, surfing the net should be a different value transaction than someone performing, essential mission-critical first responder service or healthcare service, wherever that might be. We have an opportunity to do that as we kind of leverage that technology as well. So it's capacity at a better per-unit cost and enabling business cases that are different from today's world.
And you talked about it a little bit earlier, but going back to wireless margins, in terms of you feel like you could still improve the margin without necessarily and lower churn without necessarily increasing costs. We saw a nice improvement in the first quarter year over year. Should we expect that kind of going forward as these initiatives kind of continue to roll through?
We don't provide specific guidance around margins, but what we have said is that we are striving for a 200 basis point improvement in each of our wireless and cable businesses using 2016 as a baseline by the end of 2018. So we're on track to do exactly that in both those businesses. We're kind of, just over halfway there, and we can look at our guidance. You can easily reverse engineer where we're headed to from that perspective.
And you mentioned it a little bit on the CapEx side in terms of the build, the network uplift. It was running kind of below the normal level, 10-12%. Now it's kind of come back up. How long should we see what's driving the increase, and how long should we see it at that? What's the natural long-term level?
So you're right. We were kind of running, below sort of industry peer levels in terms of CapEx intensity and wireless because we waited for the right moment in time to do the uplift to 4.5G. I think it served us well. We're seeing better unit costs for equipment as a result, and now the equipment is actually 5G ready, where early 4.5G equipment now needs to be replaced for those that went very early in the process. So, that's good from that perspective. You should expect to see us in line with industry peers over sort of an appreciable horizon or period of time. There will be sort of ups and downs in a given year, but we're committed to being in that sort of industry peer zone as a whole.
Now, moving over to the cable business, losses were about half of what they were a year ago. What are you doing in terms of mitigating some of the overbuilding that is going on in your markets?
With respect to, you're talking about video losses.
Yeah,
on the internet side, we've grown internet penetration now consistently every quarter for the last 11 quarters. So really feel we have a superior product in the 1 gig service offering, and it's competing well against our competitors in the marketplace. You're right, on the video side of the equation, a year ago we had 24,000 video losses. This past Q1 it was 12,000. What we did is we really started to focus the attention more on the multi-product household. The easiest category of customer to get is the internet-only condo dweller looking for a promotional opportunity. And, I think as an organization historically, we've been too focused on that promotional hopper category. And all we're doing there is we're trading customers back and forth based on the next promotion. I've been pushing the team to look at the multi-product household, offer them a capability that will be stickier and have a greater lifetime value, and you're starting to see some of the efforts of that focus. The thing is that we're still only fighting with one hand and the other hand tied behind our backs. Our legacy TV product is just that, a legacy TV product. We're in the midst of an employee trial around the IPTV version of Xfinity, and it is a great product rate solution. Once we get that to market, I think we'll have both hands to fight with, and you'll see an even greater opportunity for us with respect to lifetime value of the household and overall economics of the household.
And it's gotten very good reviews. What have the employees said about it, and how should we expect it to be rolled out over time?
The employees love it. We now have it in over 2,000 employee homes, and we're adding anywhere from 300 to 400 a week. We've got great demand from employees, as many as 6,000 in backlog waiting for the installation. The goal was very much to create the excitement inside the house to make it relevant and important to all of our people who will be serving our customers, but also, more importantly, pressure testing all of the operational and support processes. The platform works very well. It is the same platform that Comcast is using, the same sort of that they are trialing in different parts of the country in the U.S. I've had it in my home since October. I think it's a great product that has a lot of wonderful features, not just voice control, but deep Netflix integration, cloud PVR, We're going to be having a bunch of other capabilities that will make a difference in the marketplace. Employees are really giving us great feedback. We've asked them to be very tough, very brutal on us, because we don't want to sugarcoat it internally. And the feedback has been terrific. Our plan is to have a soft launch in the next few months and then do a full-scale launch later this year. We're not talking about exact dates for sensitivity reasons, but we're ready to go in carrying out that approach. And then at some point over the next little while, we will stop sell the legacy product and really drive a full rollover of our base over the next few years.
And can you talk a little bit about how your cost structure is going to change, both in the OPEX and CAPEX side, as you roll out X1 through your markets? It's probably you're spending a little bit more now in CAPEX, but over time, where will that go, and how will that impact your OPEX too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, cable CAPEX intensity is higher right now. Our resting heart rate on CAPEX intensity will be much lower in the next few years. One driven by the implementation efforts around the platform itself, the one-time upfront costs. The other thing that will help bring it down from a CAPEX point of view is the cost of installation will go down dramatically. Right now, the average home costs us about $1,100 to install. It's a combination of labor, a couple of HD PVR boxes, a gateway, some wiring, just the effort of doing that. The equivalent household in the X1 IPTV world will be closer to about $400. So inherently, on a per-home basis, that's a substantial improvement. Add to that some of the operating improvements along the way. There are a number of capabilities with the product that allow us to see deeply into the home and look at all the endpoints. And as a result, we can do a lot more troubleshooting before we even arrive at the house. Also, if you look at the content discovery capabilities of the product, it's very good. You know, I've stopped using the programming guide. I'm using the voice command. I can see what's available on different services. And our goal is to be agnostic to OTT services and really incorporate all the possible capabilities that are there so people never have to leave our environment. And they can watch on Netflix. They can program something on their PVR from the cloud. They can buy it from our on-demand catalog, and we'll keep integrating other OTT providers over the fullness of time. And we think that discoverability will drive a far better on-demand improvement in revenue and stickiness overall for the home. And that's the real value, is stickiness for the home.
So it seems like there's a churn, lowering the churn component. People are happier. They want to use the product more and don't want to switch. But there also could be a revenue uplift from the on-demand and maybe other ancillary services that can be put on there.
Absolutely. But we do think that internet is the anchor to the home. The entire focus really is around internet. Internet is the new dial tone, if we can call it that. And right now, internet ARPU sits at around $70 for us. We're on a mission to keep driving that internet ARPU. We've been growing about 5 or 10% per year. I want to get to a point where the video revenue growth is a nice to have, where the economics of that cable business improves based on the merits of the internet capability in and of itself and everything else around it that we're going to wrap around the smart home. And it's not just video entertainment services. We're talking about alarm monitoring and the smart home support. We're talking about all the home automation ideas that sit on the roadmap beyond the Xfinity video platform. All of them will be opportunities to continue to drive lifetime revenue and continue to drive churn improvement and make the home stickier for that anchor product being internet.
If anyone wants to ask a question, please raise your hand. We'll get you a microphone. But wanted to kind of finish up with the cable. Bell is starting to mass market their fiber in Toronto. What are you seeing initial reactions to the mass marketing and as they build out?
So just a couple of points to think about in that context. First of all, if you look at our footprint in Ontario, roughly 4 million homes, Bell's penetration in that entire footprint we estimate to be at about 25% with fiber to the prem. So there's Toronto proper, and then there's the Greater Toronto Area, and all of Ontario. It is the largest mass of homes and value in the country. So it's the most the broadest, most important market from a residential services point of view. Number one is the comment. The second comment I would make is that we've been competing with Bell for 10 years as it relates to fiber services. First fiber to the node, and then fiber to the prem. And bear in mind what I said earlier, you know, for the last 5 to 7 years, we've been driving fiber to the prem in new homes and in condo buildings. And when housing starts are growing by about 2% per year from the last number of years, that's an appreciable part of our base as well. So we have many instances of communities where we're competing fiber to fiber, we're competing fiber to coax, we're competing fiber to DSL, we're competing fiber to ATM. So we've got all these different sort of conditions and areas, and I think we feel comfortable in all those different realms overall in terms of the level of capability. We have a superior internet product, 1 gig availability across the entire footprint. And with the advent of X1, I think we'll have the other part of the equation. And we have been growing internet penetration now for the last 11 quarters. You look at our results quarter in and quarter out. Our competitor has about twice the footprint that we have. And, you know, on a sort of internet additions per size of footprint, I think we perform very well.
Yeah. Just kind of finishing up with the X1 part, you said you feel like you're fighting with one hand and tied behind your back. Is this going to be kind of a sea change for you to be able to kind of have this level of sophistication for this part of the video business, and maybe you could gain back share or keep a bigger share?
I think it's a very important change for us. I mean, I internally have been calling it, you know, the revenge of cable. I mean, it's kind of back with a great interface, great capability. That is not trying to fight OTT, but integrating it into the offering, and is leveraging the power of current technology for discovery and use in terms of the household, which I think is an important part of that overall consideration. I do think that it's a game changer for us. It's going to happen over time, Richard. It's not sort of something that's going to happen overnight. We're going to roll it across our base in a very systematic fashion as a whole. There's a lot of excitement around the product and the offering. What's even more exciting is, you know, we've had the benefit of seeing the roadmap for both the X-Fi services and the X-Home services that are behind it. Mm-hmm. And there are a series of offerings and innovations that I think are even more compelling around really bringing the power of the automated home to the mass market. Right now, if you have any number of connected devices in your home, you probably have as many apps to try to control them and manage them. Bringing those all together into one environment, integrating it with internet and video, I think is a very powerful combination.
Any questions, or I'll keep going? In terms of capital allocation, it seems like this is an investment period, both in wireless and cable. But once you get through this, it seems like not only are the numbers going to be better, the investments can be pulled back. Is that when we're going to see the dividend start to grow again, or is it going to take a little bit longer than that?
What I said to my team, it's been just over 12 months since I've taken over at the helm of Rogers. I said our primary focus, above and beyond all else, has to be to grow the core business and reinforce the long-term sustainable financial results of this organization, the growth that goes into those investments so that we can continue to generate the types of returns that you're seeing from us. That's sort of job one. Our goal is also to bring balance sheet leverage to a different place. We kind of were up as high as 3.3. We kind of closed the year at sort of 2.8. We're down to 2.7. We're headed to 2.6. I'd like to see the balance sheet leverage get to 2.5 or below. We feel confident around the guidance that we put forward for the year. We don't have any other sort of extraneous uses for our cash, if that's part of the question as well. We're very much focused on the core business. And therefore, there'll be a moment in time in the future where we will revisit the notion of increasing the dividend. We're committed to a cash return model to shareholders, combination of dividends and share buybacks. So it's a question of when, not a question of if.
Great. I think we're out of time.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Thank you.